Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. This is Jim Marty calling in from beautiful September weather in Denver, Colorado, 76 degrees and not a cloud in the sky. Larry, up in Chicago.
Hey, Jim, how are you? Great to hear from you again. We're on a weather roller coaster. The last day or two, the temperatures dipped back down into the 50s, into the 40s at night, giving us just enough of a chill. And so all of a sudden, everybody's missing those 80-degree days that a few weeks ago we were complaining about how hot it was. But that's okay. You know, this weather's certainly appropriate for this time of year. And, you know, it makes me think of sitting outside at football games that aren't being played, or at least not being played with fans in the seats. But, you know, that's okay. We get around that. We get around live music. We find ways to survive, right? As Jerry said in Touch of Grey.
Yep. So, what's going on? Politics. We had a presidential debate this week. And as I've been saying, the word cannabis never came up. Marijuana, cannabis, just a total non-issue in this crazy election year with pandemics and protests and riots and no shortage of issues, but marijuana is not one. I really think cannabis consumption has really just become kind of mainstream where nobody cares about marijuana anymore.
You know, Jim, this is a point that you and I have long discussed, and we've kind of bemoaned the fact that on the one hand, there's not more attention paid to it. Of course, on the other hand, as we've also discussed, maybe that's a blessing in disguise for the industry, depending on how you look at it. But you're absolutely right. I mean, kind of the glass half full way to look at it. You know, we had a debate last night between two presidential candidates, and I understand both of them had a lot of other issues on their mind. But maybe what's important is that, you know, what are we now for Colorado 10 years down the road with licensed dispensaries, and nobody's complaining about it. Nobody's saying, oh my God, we have this marijuana problem out there. We all thought the dispensaries would be a good idea, but they're not. If I'm president, I pledge to shut it all down.
Yeah. Well, the two big issues that people were concerned about 7, 8 years ago for adult use, 10 years ago for medical in Colorado, were traffic fatalities and driving while impaired, but also teenage use. Right. And those two things just have not happened. Not to say there isn't teenage use, but it hasn't gone up from the days when it was illegal. And our, as I've mentioned in other shows, our traffic fatalities have stayed very flat, right around 600 a year, half of what they were in 2002. We had 1,200 traffic fatalities a year. So, the people looking at Colorado from the outside really cannot find a lot to complain about other than the burgeoning tax dollars on $2 billion worth of sales in Colorado. I think we'll see some other states come online in a few weeks, November 3rd. Arizona will be voting for adult use, and I'm quite sure that will pass. Mississippi and or Alabama are both voting for medical cannabis. So it really is a national movement that we've been part of these 10 years. And it's almost, you know, in the rearview mirror now. So just now, which a little bit of cleanup with the few remaining states that don't have some form of legal cannabis, and then the federal government coming online to normalize banking and taxation of cannabis. Really, we're just down to a few loose ends.
You know, I think you're right, and that's certainly very interesting and a great endorsement for where we are as a country with the marijuana market these days. And it is exciting to see as we go forward. And you know, it may get to the point where, you know, ultimately none of us really do care what the federal government does, because people are developing workarounds for banking. They have the advantage of working with accountants, you know, Jim, such as yourself and the Bridge West Group, who have, you know, more or less become the experts of, you know, how to handle 280E. And, you know, with that level of expertise, 280E is no longer the formidable hurdle that it used to be. That's not to say that it still doesn't have to be taken seriously, but it does mean that, you know, those of us that practice in that area, you, not me, have, you know, it's not new to you anymore. You know, you've developed an expertise. There's an established body of law now. And within that, you're able to, you know, provide the type of advice that a few years ago was probably just not possible. And, you know, that kind of thing really, really makes a huge, huge difference to the point where we can say, you know what? If it's still illegal, it's not such a big deal because it keeps the regulators out of our hair, which is not. Sure. And well, I'll tell you where that really becomes important and where we really have to be very, very careful what we wish for is if we take a look at what's going on with hemp right now. And we've talked a little bit about the this new, I love it, the DEA's interim final rule on hemp. How something can be interim and final at the same time, I think speaks to the craziness of the government even addressing it at all in the way they do. But this is just the DEA once again waking up every now and then, trying to take advantage of what they say is ambiguity in the 2018 Farm Bill, in a way to kind of tighten up it, what's otherwise loosening grip on hemp. Now, you know, we use the word cannabis in that sentence instead of hemp. I think that's where a lot of the trouble comes in because, you know, the DEA, like a lot of other people and groups out there, don't seem to want to really recognize the very clear distinction between marijuana and hemp, right? So what we do now is we have, once again, like, what was it? Was it 2016 or 17 when the DEA came out with their last set of quote-unquote interim rules and they were trying to give CBD its own Controlled Substances Act identification number. Ultimately, the courts told them they couldn't do it. That was in a lawsuit that was filed by the Hoban Law Group. The Hoban Law Group has now filed a lawsuit in the Ninth Circuit again, contesting these newest set of rules and contesting whether the DEA even has the jurisdiction to be able to promulgate these rules, let alone try to enforce them in terms of what they're talking about. And it's a really, really scary thing for the hemp industry, Jim. And, you know, a lot of people just don't understand and realize that what they've done here is they've gone beyond merely counting THC Delta 9 in their calculation for the 0.3 standard that, you know, is the current line on whether you have a legal hemp product or an illegal marijuana product. And before it was 0.3%. THC based on Delta 9. Well, what experts in the industry knew, and many of us have now come to find out, is that there are a number of active cannabinoids in hemp, including, among others, THCA and Delta 8, both of which are not included in the THC measurement previously, but both of which, if combusted and smoked, upon being burned, they do actually create a psychoactive effect, not as significant as Delta 9, but psychoactive nonetheless. And a lot of people kind of saw that as a loophole, as a way to sell intoxicating products under the Hemp Act. The DEA has now come back in and said, we mean 0.3% THC on any component of the hemp plant. So now we're talking about THCA, we're talking about Delta 8. All of these would have to be factored in. And that would change the nature of the plants that are currently being grown right now, and certainly bring down the number of these other constituents that can be allowed to cannabinoid constituents that can be allowed to exist in the plant if you don't want to lose your entire plant. We have this going on in Illinois right now. I have customers when they drop their seeds in the ground in April, 0.3%. Now they're getting ready to harvest. Boom, there's a new DEA interim rule. And guess what? If you measure their THCA and their Delta 8, they sneak right above 0.3%. That's a problem. The other place where we talk about this being a problem is in the transportation of hemp oil that's being processed. So if you have a hemp plant that is compliant and you extract hemp oil that is compliant, but then you take all the hemp oil and you concentrate it in a huge tanker truck to take it across state lines to another location, We know that in that concentration state, the THC level can spike above 0.3%. And the way the industry has handled that is by expressly labeling those products in their shipping manifests as being products in process, right, as opposed to finished products, with certifications that the plant it came out of was legal and that the products that they're going into are legal. And there was some issues with that because law enforcement groups around the country that really weren't hip yet to the rule, but had been told something about 0.3%, whether they accepted that or not, the minute they saw anything above 0.3%, they said, well, screw you, we've got you now. And the industry was pushing back very hard on that. And, you know, instead of helping the industry, the DEA kind of spit in our eye because they have now formally said that, right, if you're shipping that oil and in that concentrated state, even while it's just being shipped and it's product in process, spikes above 0.3 during that period of time, you're hauling an illegal product. It can be confiscated. You can be arrested. This is going to put a serious, serious hurdle in the middle of the cannabis, of the hemp industry, and the types of products that can now be sold, and the way that they can be shipped, the way that they can be manufactured. And it's really going to be a problem. And, you know, this is all not entirely a result of hemp becoming legal, but certainly with hemp being legal, it has attracted the attention once again of the DEA and the FDA with their food rules and everything else. And it's so disappointing to see. Like I say, the Hoban Law Group is out there filing a lawsuit, working with a couple of other law firms in an effort to try to get these rules either repealed or rolled back as much as possible. And why the DEA feels compelled to continue to go after a substance as benign as hemp, right? You know, you and I understand, Jim, that the casual listener might not understand really, but you and I understand that if we're talking about a cannabis product that's under 1% THC, you know, you're not going to get, might there be somebody with a very sensitive system to whom that might cause a psychoactive effect? I suppose, but to the average person, it's going to be a non-event. You don't feel the psychoactive effect at that level. So we have the DEA ganging up on a product that's primarily, to the extent it's used for human use as opposed to all of its industrial uses, is used for healthful purposes and has an exemplary record of, you know, safe, healthful uses. And yet here we have the government focusing its attention on trying to shut this down. It makes no sense.
No, it doesn't. As I said earlier in the show, loose ends. So this is definitely one of the loose ends. I'd really like to see this move towards what the alcohol industry does, where they test the final product and not the ingredients going in. So when you buy a bottle of wine, you know what the alcohol content is. You know, if you buy a bottle of whiskey, the alcohol content is much higher than a bottle of wine. But they don't test the grapes and they don't test the barley.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're absolutely right. And in this case, you know, even to take a position that a concentrated product, which is a natural part of the processing process and which has no intent of ever being sold, to be able to jump in that small little window of the entire processing period and say, aha, we've got you now, is to ascribe to the industry a bad faith motive that's not only unfair, but isn't close to being accurate or true. I think that the members of the hemp industry have bent over backwards to be compliant with the 0.3% rule. And, you know, to the extent that the government wants to say you can't count THCA anymore, you have to count THCA, fine, I guess. You know, that's their prerogative to add in. But when you start doing these other kind of rules that will literally shut down transportation of hemp oil, I just don't know why they're doing it. It's unnecessary. It's done, I think, for harassment purposes and because they're frustrated of the progress that the cannabis industry is making in this country.
Right. I agree. Well, switching over to musical subjects, you and I both have, during the past week, checked out Through the Cool Colorado Rain, a wonderful documentary on the history of the Grateful Dead in Colorado. And, great pictures, great stories, great history. Larry, what was your takeaway?
Well, Jim, first of all, let me tell you, having blown the homework assignment the last time you gave me, when I was not about to make that mistake again, so I sat myself down over the weekend and I took in this documentary. And here's what I'll tell you about it. I think that if you are a Colorado person or a deadhead who was at a number of the Colorado shows, it is a tremendous, tremendous resource in terms of giving you a very succinct kind of overview of all of the shows that were played in Colorado. A little bit about the things going on at the time, both socially in the area, as well as musically for the Dead. They take time to kind of point out the highlights of all of the various sets of shows that they talk about. And I think that the archival footage and the pictures, you know, for if you're a true Deadhead and you love looking at that stuff, you can't beat it. My frustration was that I think that they kind of got themselves caught in between. And you know that they could have easily tacked on another 30 minutes. This one was just checking in at about 30 minutes. They could have easily tacked on another 30 minutes and spent another 5 minutes on each of these shows, and it would have been wonderful. Of all the shows that they went through, the only ones that I had the pleasure to be at were the Red Rock shows in June of 1984. They were three of the best shows I ever saw, leading up to the third night, which was just an absolutely monumental Dead show. The picture of the perfect Dead, a second set that maybe had six, seven songs tops, but some of the best jams I've ever heard, and the breakout, Dear Mr. Fantasy. And you know, yet in that when they got to it, the da-da-da, 1984, the Dead broke out, Dear Mr. Fantasy, a lot going on in the life of the Dead. It was a very exciting year, ba ba ba. And then they moved on, and I wanted them to talk about the huge colossal rainstorm of the night before. And one of the things that was funny, and I had to go back and check this, Jim, but it when they flashed a copy of the ticket stubs for 1984 up on the screen, I recognized, you know, the designs that the Dead were typically embossing on their tickets at the time. But one thing stood out on me that I had not noticed before, and it said, in case of rain, event to be held at CU Events Center. And I thought, well, where the hell? I ran downstairs. I pulled out my ticket stub collection. Sure enough, it's on there. The second night of the three-night run, it rained, it hailed, it poured. Nobody came to us and said anything about going to the CU Events Center. We all stood outside all night in that torrential downpour, saw a tremendous show, but I got a real kick out of that, wondering, boy, if that's not enough rain to move you over, I don't know what is.
That was interesting. How many of those Grateful Dead shows in Colorado involved rain,
Yes.
even up to most recently, the last time they played at CU Boulder with Dead and Company, and John Mayer, they had a tremendous rainstorm the
Right.
first night at Boulder the summer of 2019. So
Yep.
rainstorms and Grateful Dead concerts seem to go hand in hand here in Colorado. But yeah, a lot of memories for me. Red Rocks 83 was, you know, my first Grateful Dead show in Colorado. I was at the Telluride shows in 1987. Great, wonderful shows in Telluride.
Well, I'll tell you about Telluride because a group of us had thought about going out there, but what they did in Telluride was a masterful job of marketing, right? And they were telling people, if you don't have tickets, they won't even let you into the town. Don't come out here. And we all thought, you know what? We don't need the hassle. We're not going. We don't have tickets. I'm not going to go out there and fight with the locals. And I think they did a very good job of controlling the crowd flow to Telluride that year.
They did, because there's a, you know, Telluride's at the dead end of a box canyon, so there's only one way in and one way out, so it was easy to control. But those were wonderful shows. I think in prior shows that was my one of my best Grateful Dead experiences.
Sure.
Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at Red Rocks, drive to Telluride on Friday for Saturday and Sunday shows in Telluride. Wonderful times.
Doesn't get much better.
Mickey Hart led a procession down Main Street. It was a harmonic conversion of a lining up of the planets, and some of the dancers from Prince Unatunja's Drums of Passion ended up in our condo. So crazy wild times.
I'm sure there's a good story behind that one.
Oh yeah, crazy
Very
wild
good.
times. And
Absolutely.
yeah, but I enjoyed that documentary very much. I agree
Yeah.
with you that it could have been at least another half hour and expand it out a little bit. But wonderful photos,
yep.
Some video, just amazing how many times the Grateful Dead played in Colorado in their history. And it goes on to this day with, you know, shows back in the football stadium with Dead and Company.
Well, look, we've all known that Colorado has always been a magnet, right? As I recall, although I don't hold myself out as quite as much of an aficionado on Fish history, but as I recall, I've seen a live album from Fish in Colorado in 1988. My understanding, it was one of the first major states outside of Vermont that they ever played in, or at least out of the Northeast.
Yes. There's a famous photograph of Trey and Paige. I think it's Paige, or maybe it's Mike Gordon. No, I think it's Paige. Carrying Paige's keyboard across the street in Telluride. I don't know if you've ever seen that picture.
I have seen that picture.
That was a year after the Dead. That was the story there was they ran out of money and only had enough money for gas and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches all the way back to Vermont.
So, but I love the fact that, you know, there's this history of bands coming to Colorado to really – you know, kind of expand themselves out. And one of the things you and I talked about on the pre-show that I really appreciated about that documentary was, you know, I can always learn something new every time. And one of the things that I found fascinating, and this was based on the detail they provided, was that the very first shows that the Dead played in Colorado were at a branch of the Family Dog that had been established by Chet Helms and his crew out in California as a regular venue in which the Dead played over on the Great Highway along the ocean there. And I had no idea that there was ever a Family Dog that had been in Denver, let alone that the Dead had played there. And I found that to be very cool.
Yes, I was wondering what the address was of that, if the building is still there. I'm sitting in downtown Denver right now as we speak. I could drive by and check it out if I knew the address. So, well, that's all very interesting. We still have a little bit of time left. We could touch on the 50th anniversary of American Beauty being released this week, 50 years ago. I'm old enough that I remember driving around in the car with my parents. I wasn't old enough to drive, but hearing Truckin' on the radio way back in 1970, 71 as a 8th and 9th grader.
Sure. I think that, you know, off of that album, certainly Sugar Magnolia and Trucking were songs that you would hear on the radio. Friend of the Devil, you know, used to get a decent amount of airplay. But, you know, in my pre-Dead days, it was just, you know, songs that I identified with the band and not really a whole lot more to it. Although they did eventually set the foundation for me becoming a Deadhead. And getting into the space. And the first show I ever went to, the Grateful Dead did play Truckin' to close out the first set. And my buddy who had taken me to the show was very excited for me because they were actually playing a song that I knew. But it's hard to believe that 50 years has gone by since American Beauty came out. And what it requires us to do, Jim, is to really, you know, take a minute and look at this album and just appreciate how magnificent it is. And by saying that, I don't mean to diminish Working Man's Dead, which came out at the same time, and I think out of the same creative streak as the boys broke away from their hardcore psychedelic persona and became more of a Americana type of band, if you will. But what we saw on American Beauty and Working Man's was the beauty for the first time really to experience the beauty of Robert Hunter's lyrics and Garcia's ability and Weir to put music to these tunes in a way that most people could appreciate. You know, your average Deadhead, I think, will tell you, oh man, I love Oxymox, I love Anthem of the Sun. But I don't think that your average person off the street, if you sat down and started playing them Anthem of the Sun, would sit through the entire album. You have to really have a hard interest in the Dead and in that period of their time and that way they played music. But I would be willing to bet that, you know, putting on American Beauty could fit in just as nicely as all the Beatles music we always hear in the elevator or, you know, public, you know, in public settings. It's It's a beautiful album. Every single song on that album stands alone in its own right as being a special song. You know, any one of these songs, if you heard any of them at a concert, it automatically made the concert better. And if you heard more than one of them, you know, it really put it over the top. And what the Dead are going to do is they're releasing their 50th anniversary. They've been doing this with all of their albums as they get to this stage. So they're going to be releasing their special 50th anniversary of American Beauty with all sorts of great information and other stuff. But what I'm really excited about is that along with it, if you order it, they're also releasing two additional discs would make up the entirety of a show that the band played on February 18th, 1971 at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York, which before the pandemic had kind of become Phil's home away from home, where he had been going back and playing a lot of shows again. But the Dead used to play there quite a bit in the early 70s. And what makes that February 18th show stand out, there's a number of things, but it was the first show ever for some tunes that are that formed the backbone of the Dead canon of songs, Wharf Rat, Playing in the Band, Bertha, Greatest Story Ever Told, and Loser were all broken out that night for the first time ever, along with the Dead also playing St. Stephen and Dark Star, which, you know, I think if you're trying to look for something that would say, where's a real crossroads in the Dead career, that show has to be it, because you've got the old psychedelic part of it, but here they are, you know, showcasing and displaying some new tunes that are all wonderful, but not the kind of tunes that you would have found on Axamaxa or on Anthem of the Sun.
Yes, and some of the documentaries, I forget the fellow's name at Warner Brothers, was so happy with Working Man's Dead and American Beauty because he said, finally, we have some 3 and 4 minute songs we can play on the radio.
Exactly. Right. That, which is great. You know, when you listen to these songs and they are, you know, the quote unquote, you know, radio or record version of them. And I will just tell you in passing, if you've never heard it, it never came out on an album, but they released it on a 45. And you can sometimes pick it up in other collections, is the radio version of Dark Star. Hmm. And you have to hear it. It's about 3.5 minutes long. It just rolls right along. It's very funny to listen to.
Interesting.
The other thing about this show that's really interesting is that Ned Logan sat in on them to play piano all night. Ned had played the piano on the Candyman recording on American Beauty, and he actually sat in with the band that night. And I'm looking forward to getting the show to listen to because I've been told that his presence can be heard. You know, and that was during a period of time when I don't think Pigpen had quite yet started his downward spiral. But certainly, you know, to be able to get somebody like Ned in, who's probably a little bit more of a classical pianist, probably paved the way ultimately for a guy like Keith Gauchow, who then, you know, subsequently came in after Pigpen was gone and really brought a classical piano sense to the Grateful Dead throughout the 1970s.
Very good. Yeah, very interesting. You know, speaking of the Dead's old psychedelic days, did you know that Viola Blues is a cover?
Here's something that's fascinating. Yes, and I think I had known that because I had been listening to it for a while. But think about this. On the Grateful Dead's first album, the one that opens with The Golden Road to Unlimited Devotion.
Right.
It has Morning to It. That song has like 9 or 10 songs on it. The only songs that are original Grateful Dead compositions are Golden Road and Cream Puff War. And Cream Puff War was written entirely by Jerry, including the lyrics, no Robert Hunter contribution. But every other song on that first album, Cold Rain and Snow, Morning Dew, songs that we think of as being, you know, standard classic Grateful Dead songs are in fact cover tunes.
Yes. We only figured that out. We were listening to Viola Lee Blues at the house, and I wanted to check out the lyrics. I went to my Grateful Dead song book, yep, annotated, and it's not there.
Right, exactly so, right.
My wife looked it up on her phone, and it was written like in 1925, and I forget, yep, the man's name, but it was an old black blues singer from the South, I would imagine. Yep. Maybe I'll do a little research on that for next week's show.
Well, that would be great. And Viola Lee Blues is a special song. Years ago, they released a CD called From the Fill Zone, and it was a random collection of about 9 or 10 different live recordings of particular songs that Phil had picked and put onto one album. And one of them was a version of Viola Lee Blues. And in the liner notes, Phil talks about how, you know, in the early years of the Dead, that was their jam vehicle, that tune. You know, before playing in the band, before a lot of those songs, when they were looking for a song they could just play and stretch out, it was, in fact, Viola Lee Blues. And, you know, in some of those versions, they stretch it out 15, 20 minutes, you know, for a song that has very, very few lyrics, but a very distinctive sound and melody. But here's, I think, an indication of the importance that it had in the Dead catalog. In the late 1990s, you know, Phil Lesh had to have his liver transplant because of his hepatitis and his other conditions, which he was able to do, and gradually brought himself back to health and got to the point where he was ready to come back to live performances again. And so he planned his first live performance post all of this to be at the I can't think of the name of it now, in San Francisco, the really fancy place, not the Fillmore. I'll think of the name of it in a minute, but the Warfield Theater. And with Phish as his backing band, although I don't know if people knew that Phish was going to be his backing band in the show. I have a tape of it. The show starts with Phil and his two young sons, Graham and the other one, who are now regular members of his band. And they came out in front and they sang Hello, Old Friend a cappella, brought the crowd down, you know, in tears and everything. They finish, the curtain goes up, and Phil and Phish jump into a 45-minute Viola Lee Blues that's unlike anything I've ever heard before. And I'll find my copy of it and send it over to you. You can also probably pull it down off of YouTube. Phil's Return, Viola Lee Blues with Phish. It's just, if you're looking for a great version of it, that's it.
Excellent. Well, I see we're coming to the end of our time slot. I will do a little research on Viola Lee Blues for next week's show. And this is Jim Marty from Denver, Colorado, saying over and out until next time. Larry?
Jim, thanks again as always. It's always the highlight of my week to be able to sit down and spend a few minutes with you talking about the Grateful Dead and marijuana. And this week was no different, especially getting to talk about an album like American Beauty that for so many Deadheads, I'm sure, really, you know, was their gateway drug, if you will, into the band. But otherwise, yes, I will look forward to speaking with you next week. There's always a hope we'll know more here in Illinois. But if not, we'll keep our fingers crossed and see where it gets us. To everyone, have a good week. Stay healthy. Enjoy your marijuana responsibly, and thank you for listening.